From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Kevin Costner. He's played a legendary minor league ball player, a cavalry lieutenant who comes to live among Sioux Indians, and a federal agent out to get Al Capone. In his latest film, Mr. Brooks, he's a respected family man with a secret life as a serial killer. It's now out on DVD. Brad Bird wrote and directed the animated film Ratatouille after he made The Incredibles. We'll talk with Bird and comic Patton Oswalt, who voices the main character Remy. The entire runs of the shows Twin Peaks, Seinfeld, and My So-Called Life are now available as big DVD box sets. David Bianculli has the details. And film critic David Edelstein reviews American Gangster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Costner, has been one of the most recognized faces in Hollywood for 20 years, emerging as a leading man from films like No Way Out, The Untouchables, and Bull Durham, then directing and starring in Dances with Wolves, which won 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Among his other films are Field of Dreams, JFK, Waterworld, Ten Cup, 13 Days, and The Upside of Anger. Costner's most recent film, Mr. Brooks, is now out on DVD. I spoke to Kevin Costner in May, when Mr. Brooks was first released. In it, Costner's role is a dark one. He plays Earl Brooks, a successful business owner and family man who has a secret life as a serial killer. The film is about his struggle with an addiction to the thrill of murder, and he frequently argues with his evil alter ego, Marshall, played by William Hurt. In this scene, Mr. Brooks is at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, where he doesn't reveal the nature of his addiction, and he's challenged by his dark side, Marshall.
Hi, my name's Earl, and I'm an addict. Anyone else?
If you were honest, you'd step up there and say, "Hi, I'm Earl. I killed 2 people last night. I really got off on it, but I need your help to be cured."
I'm different, Marshall. I won't argue that with you. But this is the only place that has ever helped me be normal, and I have been straight up until last night for the past 2 years. I'm not going to kill again. And I am not going to quit coming here because it upsets you.
Well, Kevin Costner, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you figure out how to play a serial killer? And as you say, in this case, one who's a very empathetic character in parts of his life.
Yeah, it almost does a disservice to just start off with serial killer, because immediately you're just going to eliminate a certain part of the audience, probably including me, that says, "Gee, I just don't want to go see a movie about that. Sorry, I like you very much, but thanks, but no thanks." I don't like serial killer movies. I don't like finding myself in a room with blood on the walls or, you know, too much silence. I don't like scary movies. You know, I don't like the haunted house situations. They genuinely, I guess, scare me. Hate to admit that, since I play a lot of superheroes. But in terms of how I played it, I obviously had all the research at the tip of my fingers. Unfortunately, that's the condition of our society, that we have these people all around us now, and there's probably not a channel, not an hour in the day that you can't find some channel devoted to this horrific situation that we see played out almost daily and weekly.
One of the things that William Hurt said in the production notes was that interplay between you and he reminded him of mirror exercises. What does he mean?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we both really loved is, you know, we've had these careers where now we're kind of known around the world and among our own colleagues. But I think sometimes it's so fun to look back at your journey and how, before anyone knew you, you know, you look fondly back at class and the exercises that you performed and how you, you know, mimic each other. And there's 100 games you play as an actor. And I think those that love acting the most love all the games. And William's talking about exercises that one does in mimicking each other and voice quality and kind of value for value acting, whether it's voice or a physical movement.
Oh, so you're not standing in front of a mirror, you're standing in front of another actor mimicking each other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're and again, we're playing the same guy. It forced us to go into our bag of tricks.
I want to talk a little bit about your career. You grew up in California, from what I gather, a more or less normal existence to the extent anybody has one. Played sports in high school, and what was the impulse that pushed you into performing, into acting?
Well, I really, I was born in Compton, lived for first 7-8 years, and then kind of moved around a lot. Went to 4 different high schools, but. I really had a very normal childhood. I mean, we weren't poor, but we weren't rich. I just, it was only when I started seeing other people's backyard did I understand that we didn't have some of that stuff. But it was a childhood I wouldn't have traded. my upbringing was incredibly conservative, but has served me well. There are moments when I had to break out of that, and clearly the choice to become an actor was one of those. I needed to kind of get out of this maze of, what was a young man supposed to do? You're supposed to go to college, go to business, get a job and work, but something inherently in me, was a voice that was coming out saying, man, you've got to find out really what you need to be about. I mean, and when I started to contemplate acting, because I always knew that I was performance oriented, the voice kept coming back. Yeah, you're just trying to postpone going out there into the real world and working. You know, I mean,
are we talking about college or after college or?
We're talking about during college, because I could tell that I was not equipped. I mean, I know what a good student is. I think probably one of my strengths, if I have any, is the recognition of who is kind of good at what they do. And I've never been intimidated by, knowing that I wasn't the guy. I was just encouraged knowing that the guy we needed in the right spot was in the room, or we better go find him because we don't have the right guy. And if I would assess myself, I was not an academic. And so I wasn't going to do well in school. And I could see that. And when I finally did stumble on to acting late at night one night in an accounting class where I was on the left side of the bell curve all the way to the end, I read about a play in the student newspaper, Rumpelstiltskin, and if I had a tail, it would have started wagging. I immediately started to get interested. Oh, I mean, tomorrow at 12 o'clock, I can go for an audition somewhere. I was clearly excited about 12 o'clock the next day and had no interest in what was happening at that very moment with a professor who was talking about accounting. But I was excited about that possibility, and I decided to chase that. And I obviously didn't get the audition, but from there, I realized that they were providing classes one night a week. So I started to go one night a week, and one night a week turned into five nights a week, and I found it.
You know, there's a story. Sometimes these get mangled in the telling that an encounter with Richard Burton drove you to acting seriously. Is that right?
It did. It was a significant moment. Make no mistake. I think that's why it's lived a little bit in the consciousness of people. I did see him on a plane, and it was right around the time when I was saying. I was already taking these classes, and I was thinking, do I want to do this? And I desperately wanted to talk to him, and he had bought all the seats around him on the plane so that no one could talk to him. clearly everybody was watching him, and I was watching him. But at one moment, I just felt so compelled to go up to him, and his reaction could have been 100 different things to me, but it was incredibly generous. I think he was reading Gore Vidal's Lincoln at that moment, and he said, I will answer a question when I'm done reading or something like that. So I literally watched him for the next hour. And when he finally put the book down, I thought it was my moment. And then he leaned his seat back and went to sleep. And I thought, he's forgotten about me. And he took a little cat nap in about 15 minutes. He kind of woke up and looked back at me, and he kind of waved me up. And what we talked about was very, it was very sweet. And I asked him a couple questions, which... to this day, I wish that we could have circled back to each other to talk about. But it was significant, but how important, I don't know. I just saw him, and I thought, this is what I want to do.
Well, you got into acting, and I know that Lawrence Kasdan cast you for a role in The Big Chill, which is the answer to a trivia question. You're the guy at the beginning of the movie who's the cadaver who's being dressed for the funeral.
What's that worth now in Trivial Pursuits? Is it 50 points or what?
and then you're in Silverado, that great sweeping Western that he makes. And you had a string of really successful films early. I mean, No Way Out, where you played the Navy ensign, and The Untouchables.
Right.
And then kind of that enduring favorite, Bull Durham. You know, this has taken you back 20 years now, I know, but those of us who still love and admire that movie just continue to quote it at ball games and all. Does it hold a special place in your heart, too?
Well, it does. I Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, those movies, for that matter, Love of the Game, those three particular movies are, I guess, represent my franchise. They're my sequels, I guess. But
Custer Baseball Collection. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess they are. You know, they're really standalone movies, and I've the architecture of my career has been the standalone movie for the most part. And those movies were absolutely individual, yet, you know, circled the same subject.
Well, let's hear a clip from Bull Durham. This is, you of course play Crash Davis, who is a veteran catcher with almost enough talent to make the big leagues, but basically has spent a career in the minor leagues. And in this film, he's at the Durham Bulls, and his job is to groom a young pitching talent, Nuke LaLouche, and you dispense advice. This is late in the film, where Nuke has finally gotten called up to the big leagues. You're kind of feeling down about your own career, but you sit and give him a last piece of advice. Let's listen.
Look, Nuke, these big league hitters are going to light you up like a pinball machine for a while, right? Don't worry about it. You be cocky and arrogant, even when you're getting beat. It's a secret. You got to play this game with fear and arrogance.
Fear and ignorance.
No. Fear and arrogance, all right? You hayseed, not ignorance.
No, I know. I just like seeing you get all worked up.
And that's Tim Robbins and my guest Kevin Costner from the classic Bull Durham. It's one of my favorite films, and you seem to just perfectly embody the swagger of a ball player. Where did that come from? Do you have a history with baseball before that?
Yeah, I played it early in my life, and it's really a game that I always felt like I understood, and played it in the street, played it on an organized level, and a lot of people dream about being able to play professional baseball, and you could put me in that same same category, and I've been able to now play it, and I've been able to pitch a perfect game in Yankee Stadium with Vin Scully announcing it, so it's
Right, that was the film for the love of the game.
Yeah, it's been a really good ride for where that's been concerned.
Kevin Costner, his film Mr. Brooks is now out on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Kevin Costner. His most recent film, Mr. Brooks, is now out on DVD. Well, we should talk about Dances with Wolves, which is just looms large in your career. This was a Michael Blake novel adapted for the screen. And I read that, now this was, you directed this film and, of course, won the Oscar for Best Director. It also won Best Picture and five other awards that year. But I read that you actually envisioned someone else directing it, right?
I did. I initially asked two very prominent directors. I won't name them. And both of them saw flaws in the script. I don't think they saw them as, they might have saw them as flaws in the script, but they recognized the conventions of modern day filmmaking. And the first one identified that he felt that that maybe the Civil War sequence, because I told him that the movie was long, and as they looked at it, they immediately thought that maybe we didn't need the opening Civil War sequence. It took up about 15 or 20 minutes where, you know, it established it kind of who he was. And I saw, and you could see that was a natural cut in a film, but I thought, no, I don't want to do that. And then the other one suggested that maybe the Mary McDonald character should be, you know, a Native American woman, that her being a white captive was maybe a bit cliche. And I thought, no, I mean, I can understand why they might think that, but that if you know anything about the American frontier, white captives was a way of life. It was a way of commerce. It just is what happened when you had this migratory march across this continent without any kind of military being around. It was, a lot of people think of it in a sense about Indians, about Native Americans, and I take I'm happy that they think that, but it really was a white man's story who ventured in.
Well, let's hear a cut from Dances with Wolves. This is a moment well into the film where you as Lieutenant Dunbar have settled with this Lakota Sioux tribe, and they are going off to fight a war. You wanted to be involved, but Kicking Bird, who was the one of the men that you've come to deal with, has said, no, you should stay behind. And this scene is translated through the Merritt McDonald character, whose name is Stands With Fist, I think.
Yes.
So let's listen to this cut from Dances With Wolves.
Tiwahi mitawakile awayanka okihi sechalo.
He also asked that you watch over his family while he is gone. This thing he asks is a great honor for you.
Tell him that I would be happy to watch over his family.
Huh, okihi kea. He thanks Dances with Wolves for coming.
Who's Dances with Wolves?
It is the name which all the people are calling you now.
And that's from Dances with Wolves, directed by our guest Kevin Costner. One of the things that was interesting about this film was that so much of the film is actually in subtitles with Indian character speaking the Lakota Sioux
right.
language. And
right.
I imagine that might not have been so easy for a studio to digest. Talk a little bit about how you decided to use the Lakota language and, you know, mechanically. I mean, not that many people speak it. You have
right.
to learn
some of it. Well, as we took the movie around, it was passed on a, you know, we did the whole circuit through town and it was passed on. I was on my second lap and literally at the last studio, and the comment that came back was, Kev, we understand what you're talking about. We understand that you want to make this movie long, but the thing that is bothering us is the subtitles. We're just not sure that it's going to fly. I thought, you know, it's so funny because I think that's what makes the movie is the sense of humor, the sense of kind of what really caused so much conflict on the frontier was our inability to communicate. And that was kind of the pivot point for me on this movie, that these people who desperately should be talking to each other, want to talk to each other, couldn't. And this simple language allowed fear and everything to slide in. And so I looked at everybody in the meeting. I go, you know, the subtitles have to be there. And at that point, they really couldn't make the movie. And I decided to throw a last chip into the pot, if you will. And I said, by the way, I also want to have final cut on it. I remember as I left the room, my partner, as we shut the door, he pulled me right against the wall, just literally, you know, just outside the door, and goes, what was that about? I said, what was what about? He says, the final cut, what was that about? Why'd you have to throw that in? And I said, well, Jimmy, you know, it just dawned on me that if people don't understand completely about how the movie is, how can we also put somebody in the position of cutting this movie? It was kind of a bold move, but it kind of almost like becoming an actor. A lot of things just became clear.
If you're just joining me, my guest is actor Kevin Costner. His new film is Mr. Brooks. The story is about Kevin Costner's career. Always talk about, there was the enormous success with Dances with Wolves, and then there's what's called The Slump. Waterworld, most expensive film ever made at that time. You know, mixed reviews, and then Postman, not so good reviews. How do you look at that period? I mean, do you see it as a slump?
Well, I think if you look at things empirically, if you want to look at things empirically and talk about money, then Waterworld certainly paid for itself multiple times. It's very difficult to get anybody to write that, but that was a very financially successful movie, and a movie that's kind of loved around the world. People are almost ashamed to say, I get it all the time, hey, Kev, by the way, I liked Waterworld. Uh-huh. It was flawed, as are all movies that I've been a part of, and it has its flaws, but I understand kind of what you're asking. I've just always kind of put my stock in the individual movie, and I go forward. I like The Postman, but I can't, you know, sit and try to convince someone else to like it. I like it. That's why I did it. And I don't like turning my back on my work. And but I certainly should allow other people their opinion about it.
You recently directed and starred in Open Range, a Western with Robert Duvall. I mean, this is, you know, you've done Westerns a fair amount over your career. I'm thinking back to Silverado, which was, you know, you were very young and a different kind of cowboy. What do you love about this genre?
I think it's our Shakespeare, you know. I think they're, number one, very difficult to make. They're not easy. They're a lot more sophisticated than just yep and nope. And there's the black hat and the white hat, but how you get to those is if you actually really try to understand the time that people were having to live by their wits back then. It's not frontier land like in Disneyland. It's, you know, sometimes the West has become mythical, but it was a very real place 150 years ago where people were living and dying based on decisions, based on going left and right. And I think when you treat the Western that way, you have a chance to make, you know, a movie that can relate to a contemporary audience, but you don't have to kowtow to them by trying to make everything modern. If you just exist in the moment, that's why I say it's Shakespeare. You will begin to understand. I don't completely understand Shakespeare, but when I see it performed beautifully, I suddenly, 10 minutes in, begin to understand everything that's said, every nuance that's there. And the West is the same thing. I think you find the Victorian language that was going on there, that the simplicity of what one man would say to another when he wanted him to get his message. And pretty soon, you don't have to be just an American to understand that what he said was really serious.
Well, Kevin Costner, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Kevin Costner plays a family man with a secret life as a serial killer in the film Mr. Brooks, which is now out on DVD. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the animated film Ratatouille, Food and Food Pretensions. We hear from director Brad Bird and actor and comedian Patton Oswalt. Ratatouille comes out on DVD soon. David Edelstein reviews American Gangster, and David Bianculli tells us about three new box sets of classic TV shows from the 90s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Three giant box sets of complete TV series have just been released, or are about to be released, on DVD. Our TV critic David Bianculli says each of the three is wonderful, and each captures a different time in the history of network television. The three shows, Twin Peaks, My So-Called Life, and Seinfeld. Here's his review.
Each of these shows came at a very different moment in time. Twin Peaks, by David Lynch and Mark Frost, was one of the most imaginative and unusual TV series ever made when it premiered on ABC in 1990. 17 years later, it still is. Its images, music, and ideas seem just as fresh. Twin Peaks was a true water cooler show, with everybody talking about it the next day and obsessing about its Who Killed Laura Palmer murder mystery. My So-Called Life, which lasted for only one season in 1994, starred Claire Danes as a typical teenager. But the series was brilliant in the way it depicted her character and her world. The series didn't last because ABC didn't care enough then about attracting young female viewers. Although these days, when such shows as The O.C. and Gossip Girl are aimed squarely at them, My So-Called Life would be a gold mine. A platinum mine, if you figure in how much it would have exploded on the internet. And finally, you have Seinfeld, in all likelihood the last great, hugely popular situation comedy. Even if someone figures out how to make as good and bold a comedy as that again, and to make it last for 9 full seasons, nothing will come close to approaching Seinfeld in terms of the audience it drew. On television, those times are over. But if you buy these box sets, you can relive those times again. And make no mistake, before I discuss the various bonus materials of each set, I should stress that watching the shows themselves is reward enough. But what's new? On Twin Peaks The Definitive Edition, released this week by CBS and Paramount, a lot. First of all, you get the original movie-length pilot and both seasons, which previously had to be bought separately. Then the bonus material comes in, including long-lost deleted scenes, some new documentaries, and other features and goodies. The deleted scenes are interesting, but there are only 4 of them, and they're not the ones you'd probably hope to have. 3 different death scenes featuring 3 different killers were shot by David Lynch in the episode where Cheryl Lee's Madeline Ferguson was murdered. We don't see those. But we do see an extra scene involving the purchase of donuts. Yet the Twin Peaks set includes new making-of documentaries that are like catnip for fans of the show. There's even a bonus short in which Lynch meets some of the cast members to reminisce over coffee and pie. This is where Machen Amick, who played Shelley the waitress, tells Lynch she had been an actress in Los Angeles only a year when he hired her for Twin Peaks.
I had a few good acting jobs that seemed to be coming into place, and one of them was the Baywatch pilot, which I was actually filming when I met you. But so during that process of that
now,
year...
Now, tell us about Baywatch. What is that?
Baywatch was a delightful show for many years that featured a lot of people in with beautiful bodies and bathing suits and lifeguards saving people at the beach and, you know.
It's just a beach show.
It's a beach show.
Uh-huh. But
I love that. Only David Lynch would have to be told what kind of TV show Baywatch was. The cast of Seinfeld gets together, too, with series co-creator Larry David to waltz down memory lane. But this brand-new bonus special is a bigger affair, featuring lots of clips, lots of laughs, and even a very funny introduction by Jerry Seinfeld.
9 years? Jesus, Mary and Joseph, that's a long time to do a sitcom, my friends. That is how long Seinfeld ran on NBC. That's also how long it has been since the show's cast and crew went our separate ways. Unfortunately, over the past few years, Seinfeld has become something of a forgotten relic. Believe it or not, there are parts of the United States where the show can only be seen 4 times a day.
Seinfeld The Complete Series comes out next week from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's got a staggeringly hefty price, more than $275 retail. But it's beautifully packaged and even comes with a specially made coffee table book episode guide. Break it down to about $30 a season, and it almost sounds like a bargain. Finally, there's My So-Called Life. This series was released once before, years ago, but this new edition from Shout Factory, coming out this week, is loaded with features that themselves are loaded with new insights. Claire Danes, for example, was one of 2 young New York actresses looked at for the central role. The other? Alicia Silverstone, who starred in Clueless instead. Series creator Winnie Holzman and executive producers Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz went with Danes, even though she was only 15, which meant she couldn't work more than 5 hours a day. And that meant the show had to be written to pay attention to the full ensemble, including the parents. And that's what made it so special. That, and its universality. Here's a snippet from one of the documentaries, with a taste of Claire Danes' voiceover narration from the pilot, followed by Herskovitz talking about the characters and the show's appeal.
I cannot bring myself to eat a well-balanced meal in front of my mother. It just means too much to her.
We always felt that this show would appeal to everyone. We felt because everyone either wants to be a teenager, is a teenager, or was a teenager, and those years are so powerful and evocative, you know, nobody forgets what they were like in high school.
My So-Called Life never caught on. Twin Peaks started strong, but faded fast. Seinfeld started slowly, but built into a monster hit. All three of them are unique triumphs in their respective genres. And now, all three are getting the full DVD treatment they deserve.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Brad Bird and Patton Oswalt of the film Ratatouille. This is Fresh Air. The animated film Ratatouille is out on DVD Tuesday. Our guests are Brad Bird, the writer and director, and comedian Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character, Remy. Remy is a rat whose exquisite sense of smell and taste make him yearn to be a chef. Bird wrote and directed the animated film The Incredibles. Patton Oswalt co-starred in The King of Queens and organized the comedy tour The Comedians of Comedy. Terry spoke to Brad Bird and Patton Oswalt in June when Ratatouille was first in theaters. Here's a scene from Ratatouille with Oswalt as the rat Remy. Remy is talking to the ghost of the late celebrated chef and restaurant owner Gaston in the rafters of Gaston's old restaurant. They're looking down into the kitchen where the porter has accidentally knocked the soup pot from the stove and is desperately trying to recreate the soup, throwing everything in sight into the pot. Gaston speaks first.
Now, who is that?
Oh, him? He's nobody.
Not nobody. He is part of the kitchen.
He's a plongeur or something. He washes dishes or takes out the garbage. He doesn't cook.
But he could.
No.
How do you know? What do I always say? Anyone can cook.
Well, yeah, anyone can. That doesn't mean that anyone should.
Well, that is not stopping him. See?
What is he doing? No! No! No, this is terrible! He's ruining the soup! And nobody's noticing it! It's your restaurant! Do something!
What can I do? I am a figment of your imagination.
But he's ruining the soup! You gotta tell someone that he's not...
Patton, what was your reaction when you got the call saying, you're perfect to play a rat?
I think my reaction was more, I wasn't even concentrating on, oh, I'm going to be a rat, was that I had gotten a call from Pixar, and it was a Pixar movie being directed by Brad Bird, because I'm such a Pixar fan from back in the day. I mean, the short films, Luxo Jr. and Red's Dream, I would see them at animation festivals, and then I watched all the Pixar films.
You're a nerd, so, Patton.
So I'm a huge Pixar nerd, so it's like asking... You know, a guy, it's like asking some weird Star Trek shut-in, hey, would you like to play Kirk's son? Excuse me, what? All right, you know, you can't even, I couldn't even get my mind around that I was doing this. Luckily, it was a two-year process of doing the voice, so I've been able to get my footing at this point. You know, if it had been quicker, I would be the worst guy to promote this movie. Because I would just be me going, I can't believe I met Brad Bird and we talked and we had sandwiches. Okay, so this is weird. It would be so pathetic. He wouldn't want to talk to me right now.
Brad Bird, did you cast Patton Oswalt, and what made you think that his voice would be perfect for the main rat?
Well, actually, you know, he was talking. I heard of this comedy routine he did, Black Angus, about Black Angus, and it was. he was so volatile but about food and so passionate and funny about it, you know. It just struck me that's the character, you know. He's so volatile. And but in a good way. I mean, Patton has very strong opinions about anything, and he'll let you know. And when he loves something, he loves it, and when he hates something, he hates it. And that kind of extreme emotion is perfect for Remy, you know.
Patton, can you do a little bit of the Black Angus bit that Brad Bird heard you do?
Yes, it is very early in L.A. I'll try to do it with the same energy that he heard it. But basically, it's about how the commercials for the Black Angus restaurant, and Black Angus used to be a very friendly restaurant where I come in and have a steak and have a baked potato. It'll be a good time, and you go, that sounds fine. And then over the past few years, the commercials have turned into this like gauntlet of threatening food where it doesn't even look pleasant anymore. And there's this, it sounds like an initiation rite now. At Black Angus, we'll start you off with an appetizer platter featuring 5 jumbo deep fried gulp shrimp served with a side of our butter and cheese cream soup and 15 of our potato bacon bombs and a big bowl of pork cracklings with our cheese and
what the hell, a couple
sauce.
Of corn dogs.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're like, oh, you know, we're each going to split that. No, you'll each get your own. Then we'll take you to our mile-long soup and salad bar with our He-Man 5-head of iceberg lettuce salad served in a canoe with 18 pounds of ranch dressing and what the heck, 4 cheeseburgers. Like, oh, man, you know what? How about I'll just get a little mixed green salad? Hey, I'll put on a dress and curtsy before I bring you a mixed green, buddy. Why are you yelling at me? And it just never ends.
Brad Bird, why did that make you think of the refined rat in your movie?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think it was the passion that I was responding to more than anything else. The fact that he could get so wound up about the food. You know, because, you know, Patton also talked about how he just loves steak, you know, and the weird thing is I didn't really grok that Patton was a foodie. That was just one
did
of
you
many
say
routines.
Grok?
On grok.
He just said,
yeah, that's a Steve Jobs word, by the way.
Grok?
It precedes,
hey, that's a Steve Jobs word.
It precedes
and
Steve
I
Jobs.
I learned it from
that,
Steve Jobs.
Isn't that from like Vonnegut or something?
Is
I,
it,
think
I
it's
don't
Heinlein.
Know. Steve
no,
used it.
Oh,
it's
Heinlein. Heinlein. Robert Heinlein.
Oh,
yeah.
I just nerded out again.
You out-nerded me.
No. Yes. It's Heinlein, not Vonnegut. If you think yes. No, you're wrong.
Isn't that Lovecraft?
Yeah. No, I actually heard that from Steve Jobs. So, yeah, okay. So Steve uses that word.
Okay, good.
But I didn't know that he was a foodie. We actually hired him, and he was working before I knew that he was. This is like a major thing for Patton. If he goes to any town, he scouts out what is the most happening restaurant in that town, mm-hmm. and he will send you a menu. I mean, he will email mm-hmm. you the menu from a great restaurant. And he's emailed me a few, and he'll like say, order this. And oh, you know, I mean, he's a major foodie, and that's perfect.
No, you know, the movie kind of is really enamored of wonderful food, but it also satirizes very pretentious food and pretentious people who are mm-hmm. Foodies. So in your tours of the finest restaurants as research for the movie, if you could each share one of the most pretentious food things that you experienced.
Pretentious food things. I can't think of a specific thing that, I mean, we were at the top one in Paris at the moment, you know, that 2 years ago that we went. And they had, a guy for each person at the table, you know, five of them would descend on your table at once, like a D-Day landing, and they'd go, and you'd get everything at once. You know what I mean? All the dishes would be landing at the same time hot. And, you know, the amount of coordination that would take to do that is just staggering. And they're that good, which is why they get 3 Michelin stars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as goofy as it is, we wanted to have that kind of feeling in the movie because, you know, the movie is nuts. I mean, it's a crazy idea. But if you can surround it with believable, you know, observed truths, you can kind of, that kind of buoys up the movie and makes the fantasy more believable.
Patton, what's one of the most pretentious foodie things that you witnessed?
Well, I remember Brad Bird and his wife took me and my wife to the French Laundry in Yountville as part of research. They had, it was a 17-course meal, except that my wife and I would get course A, Brad and his wife got course B, and you would taste and then pass around. So it was a 34-course tasting. And I remember near the end of the meal, it got to this point where my wife, they brought out pork loin three ways, and it was, of course, delicious, but my wife, like, took a little bite of each one, and she said, I physically, unless a waiter comes and stamps down the food, like, puts his foot down my throat, and makes me, I can't eat any more food. And the waiter gave this look like, is there a reason you're not eating this right
yes,
now?
That's
and
she's what like, look, they do.
She goes,
that's what
I
they
love
do.
It, but I'm just so full. And he looked like he was about to go back in the kitchen and get stabbed, like they were going to kill him. He looked so upset. Why aren't you eating this? We're like, because you've given us 25 courses. There was a salt course. Oh, here, okay, listen to this.
Five different kinds of salt.
There was a salt course, five different kinds of salt. This was found at a fossil dig in Montana. It dates from the Jurassic period. I'm not kidding.
He's not kidding.
Fossil salt. And is Ashton Kutcher going to come out and like yell at us?
And I think you'll be amused by its presumption. You know?
You'll be. Oh, yeah. And how about, remember the butter course that comes from a single cow?
Yes.
That they own at a.
They place And they know the Vermont. Name of the cow. They know the name of the cow. This
yeah,
came
they know
from
what it's fed.
Bossy. In Vermont. And we're one of
so
only
crazy.
Two places on earth that can get Bossy. The thing is that we're laughing about it, but at the same time, you can taste a difference.
Oh,
and
it's ridiculous.
And that's the most ridiculous thing, is that the five different kinds of salt actually do taste different.
Uh-huh.
And they actually bring different aspects out in the food. I mean, if you pay attention, on one hand, you're laughing about it because it's obsessive. You know, somebody is super into this, and is Patton is to comedy, and I am to filmmaking. But the truth of the matter is, if you're paying attention, it actually is a different experience. And the butter was different. Some of it was sweeter, and some of it was creamier. And they were all. It actually was an experience. But just next time, just a little mercy. That's all.
Well, Brad Bird, Patton Oswalt, thank you both so much for talking with us.
It's been really fun. I love your show, Terry.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Thanks, Terry.
Brad Bird wrote and directed the animated film Ratatouille. Patton Oswalt does the voice of the main character, Remy. Ratatouille is out on DVD Tuesday. Terry Gross recently recorded an interview with singer Nellie Mackay, which we'll broadcast later this month. Let's listen to a track from her new CD, which features her and singer Bob Dereau.
Something to begin with, or are you in a sandwich? Have you got some nerve? Have you got some verve? Have you got something to depend on, or do you fend or bend on? And if you say no, do you mean to go down below the earth with nothing? Now you got my name and you got my fame. Have you got something to remind you of who you used to be? That won't come true. Good news for those who pine away. The day comes shining through.
Kittens high-hatting, sitting on satin with a host whose catnip fond. For those who seize the day, the way is paved beyond.
Like this, if I'd have known, then I'd be psychic. If I had a clue, then maybe I'd be blue as a mockingbird. Why do you think she laughs so much?
I didn't know. I had such problems. If I'd have known, then I'd have solved them. But looking down the road, the Oklahoma toad's beckoning to me.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews American Gangster. This is Fresh Air. Director Ridley Scott has made such films as Blade Runner and Gladiator, but never tackled a gritty urban thriller like American Gangster. The new film stars Denzel Washington as a drug kingpin and Russell Crowe as the cop on his trail. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Reality, What a Concept, is the title of an old Robin Williams comedy album, and it runs through my mind when I see the current New York-set crime films like We Own the Night and American Gangster. Amid all the syncopated, pixelated, computer-generated Hollywood products, these films ape the gritty, jangly, hyper-realist feel of 70s movies like The French Connection, Serpico, and even blaxploitation pictures like Superfly. There's also nostalgia, a perverse nostalgia, for the days when New York was an open sewer, but at least 42nd Street wasn't a Disney property, and you didn't need $2,500 a month for a studio in the East Village. American Gangster is a whopping overdose of the 70s. As the title proclaims, it means to be nothing less than a panoramic portrait of a nation disintegrating from moral rot. The movie unfolds in a New York plagued by drug abuse and police corruption, by the trickle-down effects of Vietnam, Nixon, and racism. It could also be seen as a critique of capitalism, although it romanticizes its anti-hero almost as much as it condemns him. The film was inspired by The Return of Superfly, a magazine profile by Mark Jacobson of one-time Harlem kingpin and heroin dealer Frank Lucas, following his long stint in prison. Lucas emerged as a flamboyant sociopath, but as played by Denzel Washington, he's sleek and self-contained, disdaining flash. He imports his brothers and cousins from down south and strolls through Harlem, recalling his mentor, Bumpy Johnson.
The man I worked for had one of the biggest companies in New York City. He ran it for more than 50 years. 15 years, 8 months and 9 days. I was with him every day. I worked for him, I protected him, I looked after him, I learned from him. Bumpy was rich, but he wasn't white man rich. You see, he wasn't wealthy. He didn't own his own company. He thought he did, but he didn't. He just managed it. White man owned it, so they owned him. Nobody owns me, though.
Hey.
How you doing, baby? That's because I own my own company. My company sells a product that's better than the competition at a price that's lower than the competition.
The filmmakers don't whitewash Frank exactly. He blows a rival's brains out. He brings in heroin from Southeast Asia that's twice as strong as his competitors and sells it so cheaply that the death rate surges. But the charismatic monster of Jacobson's profile, a man who exults in his scams and brags about his murders, has become so controlled and domesticated that even with Washington's star power, he doesn't carry the movie. To be fair, he doesn't need to, since half of American Gangster centers on the obsessed detective Richie Roberts, played by Russell Crowe in a 70s haircut and corduroy jackets. Crowe is credible even with a broad New Jersey accent, but he doesn't transcend his part either. Yet another driven cop with a pigsty apartment and an ex-wife who complains he's an absent dad. He's an object of pity, a casualty of this topsy-turvy moral universe. Fellow cops shun him for seizing nearly $1 million in drug money and not pocketing it. As in The French Connection, the filmmakers underline the contrast between the honest detective's impoverishment and the gangster's obscene luxury. The director, Ridley Scott, cuts from Frank's warm-hued Thanksgiving dinner to Richie's lonely sandwich in a blue-gray twilight. Later, Scott cuts from another holiday meal to a dead junkie mother with a toddler wailing beside her. It's an important point about the fallout from Frank's good business instincts, but crudely made. Scott wouldn't need the clunky editorials if he didn't put Frank on a pedestal. American Gangster is watchable, but it feels secondhand. It's like Scarface drained of blood, at arm's length from the culture that spawned it. Crowe and Washington don't share a scene until the end, a stare-down that's tautly written and acted, but too little too late. By then, they're supposed to be allies of a sort against Josh Brolin, who plays a corrupt detective with a snidely whiplash mustache. He belittles Richie and shakes down Frank. He even has the drug dealer's dog shot. He's a cheap and cynical device to show how Frank and Richie are, on some level, united against a corruption that's bigger than they are. Whether they mean to or not, the filmmakers let Frank off the hook. He did the crime. He did the time. Now he's played by Denzel in a prestige movie. It's not a bad legacy, really.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Rabbi's Daughter by Reva Mann, a memoir about a young woman's search to find her place within her traditional community. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Aliens in America, we speak with the creators and writers of the new sitcom that airs Monday nights on the CW network. It's about a Midwestern family that takes in a Pakistani Muslim exchange student. Join us for the next Fresh Air.